you for being here. Chair knows the presence of quorum. Item of business, post-lunch is a general public comment period. We have folks wishing to make general public comments. Chris Mendoza.
Good afternoon, Chair and board members. My name is Chris Mendoza, and today I'm testifying as a member of the public. However, I'm testifying based on some earlier comments about potential improvements in efficiency in the Adapt Manager program, whether they be through CMER policy, the board, and for the newer members, I think I guess some of my recommendations are based on the 5 years I served as CMER co-chair and having gone to most of the policy meetings and a lot of these meetings. So what I'm hoping to do is maybe point out some areas that could use improvement and then some potential solutions for how to go about improving them. Earlier, I think we heard a little bit about the lean process. Having been part of that with CMER, I think was a very good exercise to go through. CMER has a pretty detailed manual on how we do business, and I think that lent itself to the lean process. I think policy, on the other hand, doesn't really have a document like that, and it didn't go through the lean process. However, that, I don't think that was a reflection of the lack of a need to. It was more of them not having a hard copy that the lean administrators could deal with. So I think that in a lot of cases, as you heard from the policy co-chairs, they do a good job of getting some of the work done that's on their plate that comes to them before CMER, or before them from CMER. At the same time, I think there's other information that comes to that body that is more difficult to deal with and can take more time. So I think what we're dealing with here is sort of a bottleneck in the system, if you will. As you recognize improvements in the CMER process through lean, and I think that we're making some gains there. As Mark Hicks said earlier, we're still working out some of the bugs. I think it's also important to recognize that there's a long list of CMER projects that are about to come before policy. I think 7 of them is what I read on there for 2014. So as you look towards increases in efficiency in that in the CMER end of things, recognize that that means that list is going to get longer. So I think that if you're going to make improvements in efficiency on one end of the chain, that those need to be repeated through the other pieces of the network. Otherwise, you'll just, that bottleneck will grow. And then lastly, I want to talk about what something that the chair mentioned concerning policy, checking in with the board for things that seem to be bogged down. And I know that CMER has a process where we red flag stuff. In other words, if it looks like there's a major problem with study design or something that's not moving forward, it gets a red flag. DNR staff, particularly their project managers, have been instrumental in helping implement a lot of that at the CMER level, and I think that's been really helpful. To the extent that it helps us sort out what are sort of little issues that could probably be worked out and what are really big issues that probably can't get worked out. And so I think that if something similar were developed for the policy committee, that that would bring more efficiency into the system by bringing those issues before the board sooner rather than later. I think one of the frustrations from a lot of folks, and this isn't pointing fingers at anybody, is when you put a lot of time and resources into getting a project done, CMER spends millions of dollars, it goes through, people put human resources into it, it gets almost to the 1 yard line, and then it slips off the table because there's not agreement in what to do with the answer or how to implement it. So taking steps to ensure that those efforts put forth do end up yielding something, an answer at least, not only does it take that issue off the table for good, but it enables the body to continue to take on more work. So there's a direct link between helping both Seamer and the policy committees finish their work while it's hot, hot off the press, if you will, to open the door and make more room for new projects to come forward. All right, thank you. Great time.
We have a little agenda adjustment before we go into the compliance monitoring report. Our diligent staff is to be commended for saving you from the chairman because this is a special board meeting and not a regular board meeting. And although the action on the earlier Grace World petition that references both Grace World issues and unstable slopes issues is a little bit awkward to vote on the same petition twice, it's pointed out to me that as a matter of Open Public Meetings Act, because today's agenda is the agenda with that item on it, we need to figure a way to navigate that. So I believe we have a suggestion as to how we might deal with that issue before the day is out, keep ourselves square. And this is, if I'm to read it quickly and be grateful for folks having thought about it in advance, is to just sort of segregate the two decisions, make that clear in the motion, and deal with the unstable slopes issue tomorrow. So, is there, I'll move that the Forest Practices Board treat Mr. Kavanaugh's July 23, 2014 letter as two rulemaking petitions, one involving slope stability rules, one involving Western Grace Squirrels. I further move the board consider Mr. Kavanaugh's Western Grace Squirrel petition at today's meeting and that the board deny this petition. As noted in the morning, Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife is currently conducting a status review and is premature to begin a rulemaking effort at this time. For that motion for discussion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Been made and seconded.
Just a question.
Little. Board Member Little.
Since we earlier, Mr. Kavanaugh was here, said we were going to deal with it tomorrow, I think it was a problem in terms of the process. I'm just asking, since we talked about this earlier and sort of indicated we're going to deal with it tomorrow, Mr. Kavanaugh is here, he's not now, does that create a problem? Do we have to address it tomorrow again, or how do we deal with that?
It doesn't create a problem. He had his opportunity to present stuff this morning, his perspective on this rulemaking. And I also had a hallway conversation with Mr. Kavanaugh, in which I indicated that it's possible that the board might take up the Western Gray Squirrel petition today rather than tomorrow. He indicated that was what he expected. He had an insulin issue and needed to leave. And that's why he left.
Discussion on the motion?
I was quiet earlier. Echo with what the other members said, but I do think it's important to recognize that the status update for the Western Gray Squirrel is ongoing, and I think we all agree that that's important, and that's the kind of information you would need to make a decision on this. The second thing is, I'm not sure what we would do with the rulemaking. I talked about this last time several times, that there isn't really a clear pathway. There was a documented problem. Something about it. But I think waiting for the status update, continuing to monitor this is appropriate. So I'll just add my ditto to the other comments made this morning.
Can I ask if there's any discomfort with that last sentence, the verbiage of that last sentence? I know we had spent a little bit of time discussing the previous motion and the nature of the correspondence between the board and the petitioners upon the explaining the board's decision. I don't think that is there intending to change the sentiment that was expressed in the earlier motion.
I would only say that I think that's only part of the reason. And I think that the ongoing work between DNR and DFW to improve communication, to do outreach to landowners, to screen FPAs, to document the screening, to document the plans that are put in place and what those plans contain, that's all kind of part of that package. And that's kind of a lot to put in there. But I think that the status review drives the ability to have information, but those other things give us some assurance that the issue isn't just being ignored in the field.
Is that perhaps a friendly amendment to strike the last sentence, just to reflect that there are multiple of issues that are on the minds of both board members, which we have captured through meeting minutes, but that we don't want to narrow the statement by the board in such a way?
Or could you just say, as noted per this morning's board discussion?
Since all those activities are ongoing, yes.
Yeah, because all that stuff was reflected in the discussion this morning, but just refer back to the entire discussion instead of just that one point.
Sure, and
among other things.
Yeah, that's the trick of that, is that we get to a point where we're listing multiple factors which have been reflected in the discussion and will be captured in the way we communicate the board's decision. So that's sort of why I might just strike it and have it reflect our earlier discussion about all of the things that were part of the information staff that was presented to us. So, Sarah?
I think it's a lot cleaner to strike it.
Okay. Is that a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay. Motion is on the amendment to strike the last sentence. Discussion on motion to strike the last sentence. Hearing none, I'd call a question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say no. Abstentions? Okay. Now we come to the amended motion. Further discussion on the amended motion.
Anything else you want to cut?
We are adroit at lengthy motions, are we not? This is unusually brief. Okay, hearing no further discussion on the motion, call a question on the overriding motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Motion carries. Thank you very much. Apologies for the go back there. We next have our biennial report on compliance monitoring. Walt and Donnell, please join us.
Yes, you're in control. So here's a pointer. I need a little number to see.
Oh, this is a later pointer?
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair and Board members. Today I'm presenting a summary of the results of the 2012 and 2013 compliance monitoring sampling that we performed a little over a year ago. This pool of FPAs included those that expired during the period of April 2012 to March 2014. So it's a full biennium's worth of sample, and it is the population was 8,109 FPAs.
Good afternoon, Board. My name is Donnell Mahan. I'm the Assistant Division Manager for Operations, and this is Walt Obermeyer, the Compliance Monitoring Program Manager, for those that have not met Walt yet and are on the phone. I may be jumping in from time to time to add clarification, but I'm going to turn it over to Walt Obermeyer now.
Thank you for the introduction and catching me there. So, of the 8,100 FPAs, so the results of 2012-2013 have been very similar to previous biennium. Road construction looked good generally. I think it was a little bit better this biennium than last, but not detectably different in any sort of statistical fashion. fish streams were again challenging. We had a challenging as they've been for many years. They average from each prescription type has averaged 52 to 91% of the four or five different prescription types under fish prescriptions. The non-fish prescription types varied from 76 to 96%, and the wetland types from 80 to 84%. And a little bit of good news in water type classification, in that the FPA's, what we are reporting seems to be a little bit improving compared to some similar but not exactly the same samples performed previously. So for the fish water in Western Washington, we have the four categories. The best of these was the no outer zone harvest. This is where the applicant stated on the FPA that they were not going to harvest anywhere within the three zones, including the outer zone, the core, the inner, and the outer. So what we did find was that it was 90% compliant, but however, if they're stating they're not harvesting within the outer zone at all, we're a little surprised to see that you really get any of these wrong, because the rule that they're judged against is the no inner zone harvest rule, where they've got 20 trees per acre that they're allowed to leave within the outer zone. So the next best was the no inner zone harvest. These.
Can we maybe get the lights down at the front room? It's a little hard to see the difference in colors.
Oh, it is. Right here, but not there. Okay. So no inner zone harvest, we had minor deviations counted for 16 of the 58, the 19 total that had deviation. Half of these were from trees that were harvested inside the inner zone, and too few outer zone trees. So that comprised this block of deviating FPAs there. In subsequent biennium, we're going to combine these two approaches because it's really essentially the same rule that applies to both. And it didn't make sense to continue on sampling without really combining these. So DFC option one is fared the worst for the entire group, just over 50%, 52%. And had deviation, over 30% of the sample had 30% of the total sample had too few outer zone trees. And that was a theme that is kind of prevalent across the board for Western Washington fish and waters. The DFC option two fared a little bit better at 60%. Neither of these categories is different is statistically different, or we can tell there's statistical difference between previous biennia. So that is something that our program wanted to look at in future biennia, and we're going to be addressing that at the end of our discussion here. Any questions on this slide? So going on to Eastern Washington type or fish waters, we had one case where in the no outer zone rule, again, there was a major non-compliance. And what this was one case, there was an RMZ, it was a long RMZ, but over half the length of the RMZ was misclassified as an NP water and should have been classified as a type F water. And they entered the outer and inner zone pretty much, and that was caused it to be entirely unsatisfactory. The No interzone harvest, fair a little better, no major non-compliance, but still not where we'd like to see it, up in the 90% level. Any questions on this slide? The non-fish water statewide, looking at, there was the type ENSs generally looked pretty good. There was one type NS, meaning the seasonal streams. There was one that was indeterminate because it was typed as an NS water, but it was considered to be have fish physicals, and seasonal waters can have fish physicals, and that was what the problem was here. We did not, some of it had fish physicals, not all of it, and so it got that typing, or that rating. There was one of the type NPs that was major, and that was again because a stream was underclassified and should have been a type F water. The rest of these and the minors were where there were just a few trees taken from the no-cut buffers or from the uppermost point of perennial flow. Wetlands generally look pretty good. The type B and forested wetlands were both above 90%. Of the, there were no major non-compliances among these. The issues on surrounding the type A's, there were a number of them, or actually one, two of them had some evidence of F physicals. One was assessed as an indeterminate non-compliance, and the other was assessed as moderate non-compliance. Any more detail required there? No. So roads generally looks pretty good statewide. 97%, we looked at 35 different road or different applications, and we essentially were walking a large proportion of the of either the road abandonment or the road construction and looking for anything that could cause it to be non-compliant or any of the rules that could cause deviation. And we found one case, and it was a diversion drain put in a slope of a road. It should have been a higher diameter pipe. It was a pretty minor deviation. Haul routes look even better. In our haul route assessment, we essentially drive at least 5 miles of the road route that we're looking at, and it can't get eyes on all the crossings and see if there's any possibility of delivery that is occurring, of sediment delivery that is occurring to any of the type waters. That's our basis for judgment there. And we found that it was 94% compliant, and compliant includes two categories, a absolutely no delivery category and a de minimis delivery where there's some evidence of a very ephemeral delivery that occurs to water, and it's very temporary and not continuing. Oops, I lost it. There we go. Thank you. You mean you don't dump what you did? Okay. Deviations at 6.3% and no high deviations at all. So we're pretty happy with the roads statewide. Then we come to the exempt 20-acre harvests. These are harvests on small landowner parcels, or small landowners who own no more than 20 acres in a parcel, and we're looking at the RMZs that occur on these harvests. We served 28 completed FPAs. We had originally planned to look at 30, but because we only found 28 completed, this occurred during the period of FPAs that were submitted, 2009, 2011, and that were expiring during our sample period. There weren't that many. The market was low, and I think a lot of the applications that were submitted, they didn't operate because of low market conditions. So we only found the 28 that we looked at. The compliance rate was 57%. This was certainly nothing that was positive. It was essentially not statistically different from the 62% that occurred in 2008. The general problems were that 28% of these had too many trees cut in the RMZ. And the rest of them were that the RMZ mistyped the water. They were either the type of water that was larger than was stated on the FPA, or they were considered a type NP and they should have been a type F. Any questions about it? So water classification. Here the news gets a little bit better. We observed 288 waters and wetlands in this sample. That is a little bit fewer than we observed the previous biennium. And 230 of those, I'm sorry, 37 of those triggered a supplemental water information form. And that is a form we use to say, hey, we don't think that this water is assessed the way they put it on the forest practice application. So that is...
Hold on, what does that mean? Weren't assessed? Just, could you go into a little bit more detail for the board?
About the assessment?
Yeah, that they triggered a SWIP.
Okay, so we go out there and look at the, and essentially walk the stream and try to emulate the rules for typing with that stream and say, we're looking at the conditions on the stream and say it's either a type NP water or type F water. And then we compare that with what they put on the application and say, oh, this thing was, they stated it was a type NP, we found type F physicals, or they stated it was a type NP, and actually we found type NS physicals, which are, so it can either be a higher classification or a lower classification than we occur. So what we found in this biennium, that there were, this 37 triggered is actually a 12% of the total. And if we looked at the previous biennium, it was 30.9% of the total. So we're finding a lot fewer of those waters that had problems at all. So now look at those that were underclassified, those the ones we're most concerned with. The 12 were underclassified. And that turns out to be 4.2% of the total of the 288 waters. Now, in the previous biennium, we did a different sampling type, just an emphasis sample on how well water typing was doing, and we found that those that were underclassified there were 21.8%, and what we discovered that those underclassified this year were 4.2%. So there appears to be some level of drop in those that are misclassified, particularly those that are underclassified. This is not brought out in the report because I'm developing some of those statistics now, and I'm going to give a fuller report next year when we look at some of this data through years past. Okay. Any questions?
Can I just ask on, so the rate of underclassification went for, although this wasn't a sample that was necessarily designed to be perfectly comparable between the two biennial reports, but it went from 20 some odd percent underclassification to 4,
mm-hmm.
but the riparian prescription compliance didn't change that much.
Right.
And that is kind of an odd, I mean, maybe it's just the...
Well, there's a little bit of an offsetting factor in there, in that the type NPs were previously assessed saying that they were either, if they were found in previous biennium, we looked at a type NP and we said it has type F physicals. We didn't call them non-compliant, we called them indeterminate. So what you may be seeing is an offsetting factor due to, okay, for 2012, 2013, we looked at these type in that were stated as type NPs, found them to be type F, and said, no, they're not compliant, they should have been treated as type NPs. So there is that little bit of offsetting factor in there. So So that's generally some good news. We need to work on that next year and to delve into those statistics to see if there's get some more solid answers. So what we found this year was that our margin of error was not what we wanted. We put a big increase in sample size in 12 and 13 to kind of build the robustness of the confidence interval, say, to give us a better ability to determine trends. We hadn't seen that. As you look at this graph here, all of these are, or most all of these are greater than 12%. And I think the greatest is 29%. The smallest is actually 10%. But we're not getting that 12%. That's what you need to have to be able to tell these trends. So we said, we got to change things. And we went through an exercise looking at other states' programs and looking at our state's program. And what we determined was that we need to change things to, because we're having a problem with, we're looking at a prescription type as a whole. There's different rules that build to these descriptions. But we're looking at it as a one prescription type, and we say that prescription is either pass or fail. And that's something we can't really dig much information out. So we're going to go back to the rules and look at each prescription rule as a, and because that provides a better assessment of variability.
So really, really quick, so envision a prescription as being an umbrella, and in that umbrella, you have lots of different rules that are captured within that. You might have anywhere from 7 to 9. So what he's just trying to describe is that variability. So prescription, just keep in your head as we continue through the presentation, 9 different rules at least, as minimal as 7. So it could be a core zone rule, inner zone rule, outer zone rule, what species type. So there's various complexities built into that prescription.
Good, and the thing about when you look at prescriptions, that adds more variability to each of the different prescription types, and it allows us to tighten up the confidence interval because we've got more of these factors which are contributing to the measure of compliance of each of the samples. I'm going to go through this with a DFC1 example. The current binomial approach that we're taking, we looked at 33 of these. There were 17 of those compliant, meets 52% compliance as a total, and the half width of the confidence interval, in other words, either side of the mean, is 13.5%. That's a pretty wide confidence interval for a sample size of 33. Under the new method we're looking at, which is a cluster sample using the individual rules, the cluster analysis, we're looking at the individual rules. So in this case, there's 232 compliant rules. That's 86.8%. The sample size is 33, and the confidence interval half width is 4.6%. This is something you can detect trends with, not this. And so we are going to, as a program, look to this method to be able to provide us that information about trends. So each of the rules that apply to DFC1, DFC1 is the most complex of any of the prescriptions that we deal with. There's 9 of these rules that apply. Species composition, is that what was put on the model? Is that the correct composition? Is the core zone there intact? Is the inner zone tree table correct? Do they left the 27 largest conifer trees per acre? Is the site class what is reported on GIS and available on record? Is the stream size, is it a small F stream or a large F stream? That varies hugely against what the results can be for these DFCs. Is there a channel migration zone? Are they present? Are there any unstable slopes? Were they bounded out if they were present? Were the outer zone all 21 trees per acre of the outer zone, 20 trees per acre of the outer zone leave left? know, all those come into play. And it makes it a pretty complex situation to hit all of those. And but it's something that needs to be done in the case to get them all right.
So really quick, species composition is the difference between Western hemlock and Doug fir. So in the model, you can put one or the other in it for those that haven't done this.
Who had the joy of going through DFC development among the current board members? One, four out of 13. So yeah, we'll need to tune ourselves up on all the opponents of DFC at some point. But I think the point that maybe you're trying to make is that right now, when we look at the compliance figures and confidence interval around DFC 1 at 52% mean, that's how many times, only 52% of the time did that prescription get every one of those components right.
Correct.
Is the thing that's measured. And the transition that the program is making is to measure those individual things instead.
Right. It's sort of like comparing just a steel rod as a supporting device versus a cable. The cable is made up of many features in each one of these rule things, and the way we're looking at it now is a rod. If one breaks, the whole thing breaks.
Well, and what that also helps do for the program, overall for the program, we can dig into the specific rules and filter out, is it written okay? Can people understand it? Does it need better clarification? Do we need to do something different? It helps us get to those pieces that we may have been missing in the way we previously sampled. So that's a boon for the program.
So, looking at how it's going to be done, or how it's being done in 2014 and in the future, the prescription will no longer be pass-fail. So there's going to be a different measurement of compliance, of different rules. The individual rules will be pass-fail. So that the smaller sample size is an outcome of the statistical analysis. We don't need to take as many samples to get a good confidence interval. And the better statistical is a result of the multiple factors, the multiple rules being considered. So what does it mean? The good news, the rules that are being observed are the same as we've done for the last several biennia. So those remain unchanged, and that's important. Trends will be detected over time. That's something we haven't been able to do well. And with this, we shall have that ability. We'll have consistency in the data. In other words, the data will be consistent as taken before and as taken in the future. We're not changing the field methodologies at all. And it's going to be feasible with a smaller sample size to have some additional samples. And now we can either expand on what would consider our standard sample or add an additional emphasis sample or two. And perhaps most importantly, we're going to have the ability to reanalyze previous data. And that's going to allow us, and it's what I intend to do in the next report, is to go back and look at the data from this previous biennium and compare it all along and see whether there's trends there that indicate, you know, either bettering or worsening of conditioning, or, you know, what particular aspects of the rules are most difficult for landowners to get right. And that's what I've got. Any questions?
A little bit more. We want to kind of talk about some of the things that we do in the program based on what compliance monitoring, all the data that they're looking at, what comes back, and the patterns that we're seeing. Based on the program, we instituted a training called the Bank Full Width Water Tightening Training. We gave it to all of our forest practices foresters, and then once we had trained all the forest practices foresters, each of the six region offices, and some have more than one meeting, they gave it at their timber, fish, and wildlife meetings. So they gave a truncated version of that to all of our TFW stakeholders. So it was an attempt to get everybody on the same page regarding water typing, really looking at where we're measuring thankful width, really focusing on under 10 feet, over 10 feet, under 15 feet, over 15 feet are very critical. And that's where it sets up really everything for the rest of your RMZ measurements. Based on a clean water assurance milestone was a piece of it, but also compliance monitoring played into it was we revised the water type mod forms. So we got more information on those forms to be able to gather better data to understand what's going on across the landscape. We revised the water type classification worksheet. We also are looking at future rule clarifications. An example is that of that is for the desired future condition model, a clarification needs to be made that it's for one side only. Don't add both sides of the RMZ to do your DFC model calculation. Board Manual Section 7 will be another piece where we can do additional information. Reminding people it might be useful to paint your outer zone leaf trees so that they don't end up being harvested. Regional forest practices foresters have also incorporated compliance components into how, from the compliance monitoring program and how they do compliance. We'll look at regional variances and say these are the areas that seem to be the most lacking in your region. And what they're doing is they're focusing on those pieces in their compliance. Now, all of these components are based on FPAs that 3 years ago and based on renewals could be further. So you have a time lag built into this entire program. We try to be as responsive as possible. As soon as we start seeing the data come in from the field, we get that information out to our regions. But for us to do major changes as far as rules, board manuals, or major trainings, we kind of want all of that data before we embark on something like that. But just so that you're aware, there's a definite time lag. So we try to get a hold of those patterns, inform people, educate, and revise where we need to, where possible.
Questions? Thanks, Tom. Former Lord.
Thank you. You mentioned something that I'd like to hear just a little bit more about. I'm interested in the regional variances and what we'll be able to see in future reports, you know, kind of a breakdown by region.
That's a good question. I will want to discuss that with the program. We try to help the regions focus on those things, but that's a good question. We can definitely look into that for the next report.
I mean, I can see how it would help you. I mean, if you do see a regional difference, it would be because somebody's doing something different. I mean, clearly at the administrative level, that'd be very useful to know. It just might help targeting, obviously.
Well, we try to capture those at the timber, fish, and wildlife meetings as well, giving people a heads up. This is what we're seeing, and that's that continued. We've got a very strong communication pattern that's taking place, and we make sure that the regions are in the loop on that. So we try to educate landowners as quickly as possible on trends that we're seeing with the data. But nothing's 100% until you get the 2 years and are able to really look at get all that data together and look at the patterns.
If I don't mind, you just mentioned TFW meetings in regions. Would you explain how often those are and who that usually is?
It depends on the region. Some are monthly, some are quarterly, some are breakfast meetings. So it depends on the regions.
These are sponsored by your
DNR has the meeting. We invite guest speakers or other people to give presentations. We usually have a large portion of informing landowners, and what we typically have the people who attend those meetings are habitat biologists from Fish and Wildlife, ecology field folks, landowners, consultants, purchasers, tribal representatives, biologists, county representation, city representation. It just kind of runs the gamut of who attends these meetings. But we typically have a pretty good turnout, but we also have an email list. So if we really want to make sure people are aware of something, we'll capture little mini information, informative pieces
like
from there. It's just an email, quick heads up sort of thing. We don't, it's just don't want the it's not a newsletter. We haven't embarked on that yet either, but.
So splitting the prescriptions out makes sense so you can target if there's patterns of where the problems are, but you're still going to measure the pass-fail for a worst practice application. The same metric we've been doing in the past, because that's kind of what we've been looking at. And if you just do, say there's 10 prescriptions, every forced practice misses one of them somewhere, you could say you're 90% successful and you're not really, every forced practice missed one. That's the way we've been measuring it.
Okay.
Or you could say they're 90, all of a sudden, that would be 0%.
So a basis for analysis now, or that we've used for producing this report, is the prescription, okay, not the FDA. Okay, so that's an FDA, it's a prescription that resides on an FDA. So the FDA is not really an analysis level.
Okay, so.
But in the future, we're going to use the rules that comprise the prescription. Those individual rules will be
I missed it. So if there's 10 rules for each prescription and every application everyone misses one,
then it'd be 90%
successful. Where their old metric would have been
0%. Correct. That's correct.
I think it's important to explain what those metrics are, but it's probably important to compare
over time
what we've been measuring. I think
right.
What you're going to do is more useful, but the numbers are very strange because you could miss one on every prescription and get a totally different number. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
It may change the number, but if every single one of those was a cortisone major deviation,
right.
That's a lot different.
That makes a difference.
So that's where the multiple, there's a lot of in those deviations, that's where we're going to target. So if we saw something like that increasing, we don't get a lot of cortisone violations. There's a minimal amount of inner zone, but where we're really seeing them is in the outer zone. So that's telling us there's a trend there. What I'm hoping is that when we move forward in this, and I totally understand your point and get the relevance of it, but it's having that ability to tease out.
So I have a couple questions. That's right. And so one has to do with, if you look, for instance, at the DFC compliance numbers overall, that's sort of one area of concern. And then there's the 20-acre exempt parcel. That seems to be another area where there's not great compliance rates, and that hasn't seemed to have changed over time. But I'm wondering, if you can sort of review what the practical resource impact is of your different categories of minor, moderate, and major. I know we've had this discussion before, but if you look at roughly 50-60% compliance rate on DFC, that's a little alarming, right? And so that's one question, just kind of clarifying what that actually means. But then I'm also wondering about the connections. These are samples. And I know that the sample sizes aren't necessarily large enough to capture a really accurate picture of what's going on the ground. But if this is reflective of what's happening on the overall landscape, is there some connection between the sort of compliance monitoring and where things are missed and, say, what's happening at CEMA or some sort of effectiveness monitoring? In other words, if things are missed, and maybe little things are missed on each application, but is there a cumulative impact to the resources that we're actually trying to protect by the fact that you're getting low compliance rates in some of these things? And I know it's related to the degree of what's missed, the complexity of the prescriptions, but just kind of trying to sew all that together and give us a picture of okay, there's some areas in which we don't have great compliance rates. Maybe there's, you know, technical operational things that can happen on the ground. But in the meantime, what does this mean for what we're actually trying to accomplish with these rules? What does it mean for water quality? What does it mean for fish habitat? Is there any place in the program, it may not be the compliance program, but where these two things are being connected and we can get a better picture of that?
I'll take the
20 acre.
I was going to take the 20 acre exemptions and look at the scale of that. Is that, can you address that?
Sure.
Okay. When we look at this 20 acre exemptions, as I said, we did not a sample, we intended to do a sample, we did an entire census of those. So of the, let's say there was 4,000 FPAs, half of the 8,000. If there's 4,000 FPAs, that would have meant that they're done in 2012 when we did that measurement. Only 28% only 28 of those are small forest landowner, or the 20 acre exempt. So in terms of the scale across the landscape, it's very small. That's not to excuse the fact that not a very high ratio, but there's one other thing we need to recognize that during that time period, that was right after the depression of 2000 or the recession of 2008, and the department lost a number of forest practice foresters during that time. When the 2008 report came out, we were planning. The department made a commitment at that time, or the program was working to make a commitment that we would go out and require the applicants that submitted these 1 acre exempt parcels to do a call-in within 48 hours of starting out. That would allow a forest practice forester to get out there on the ground and actually take a look at these on site before they started to make sure that the operator and the landowner were on board with what was going to happen out there. That never really materialized because there was a shortness of staff on that. So
there's another component to that, though, is that landowners didn't actually call in, so we didn't get the phone calls to alert them. But the other part of it is small forest landowner, what Walt was alluding to is the small forest landowner office lost a lot of their stewardship foresters. So that's a nexus where they can help, and they can go out there, and they're not the regulatory party that's looking at it. But in the overall, your question is very complicated, I think, is what we're looking at. And what I want to get to is we gather the information, and I think you're right, there are CEMER components, and we're waiting for some of that CEMER information to come back, some of the studies. I think there is the potential. There could be more. Don't know what that is, what that collaboration would look like, but it's worth digging into. I think there are already some major efforts going on that would be very helpful. Some of those have to do with shade. Some of those have to do with type N. There are board manuals kind of that could help educate people on how to connect those pieces. The compliance piece that's going out to the regions is another component of us trying to look at how, again, we can educate and inform landowners on what those pieces are. Now, as far as looking at cumulative effects of that overall total, that has not been a discussion point as of yet.
Well, I look at, for example, page 30 of the report, and it's the big confusing table of results. I happen to like the confusing table, but you look at the Western. This is for riparian and wetland parts restrictions. You can look at the ones for Western Washington and Eastern Washington. At the very bottom. Row of the table is the estimated population size for those prescriptions. So that starts to, you know, paint the picture for you of, okay, so of the DFC options that are out there, option one was an estimated population size of 140. Two was 369. The no winter zone harvest prescription by far the most commonly used one. Slightly better numbers. Not where I think anyone wants to see them. And so that starts to get to, okay, well, how much of the low numbers is spread out across the, what proportion of the landscape? And maybe if, Chris, do you, off the top of your head, are you able to rattle off where we are with some of the effectiveness monitoring studies? I know we had a lengthy conversation about that in the lead up to the master schedule vote, and that's still a bit in flux, as I recall it, from last month's discussion.
That's right.
So what that means to me is that there's an opportunity in the continuing master schedule discussions around effectiveness monitoring to start to get better knitting together, or at least patching the holes between sort of the time lag of information that we have with compliance monitoring and what accumulation of significance that pattern means for the net of resource protection.
So just that's helpful to all of you. Thank you. And just to follow up on that point, so effectiveness monitoring is looking not just at the effectiveness of the prescription as they're intended to be implemented, but as they're actually being implemented, taking into account lack of full compliance.
That'd be a better question for an AMP person than me.
It's just full compliance. Yeah, assuming full compliance.
So that's not getting at what I'm trying to get at. I mean, if there is a cumulative problem of lack of compliance, you know, do we know that? And one way to kind of parse out the numbers you guys have given is like, well, most of the non-compliance is in these moderate to minor categories. And so maybe that's not a big deal, but if it's spread out over a lot of different places, or even conversely, if it's concentrated in areas where you've got super sensitive stocks or, you know, highly endangered stocks, and that could be a problem in a different way. So if these problems persist, for instance, the last period and this period showed not much movement on those things, then it seems like this is something we need to dig into.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'd add that quietly, the department updated its strategic plan here. It was published in June. And toward that, this ongoing pattern of low-level non-compliance with punctuated with some areas of major deviation. We set the strategic direction to achieve 90% compliance on all riparian and unstable soils prescriptions. And that's a little uncommon to do, to tie yourself to a number like that, particularly when, you know, as we're looking at it, the report, I look at this report as somewhat the low point of capacity to do compliance in the field. Because as Walt pointed out, not only with respect to small forest landowner office staff, but also with respect to forest practice foresters and division staff, I mean, the program lost 30% of its general fund state, and lost 30 total positions, 25 foreign bodies. And you don't do that without having an effect on how well you can comply the applications on that. And so as we've gone through different types of revisions, like getting compliance monitoring to a place where it can help direct the effort towards specific rules that are problems or towards specific implementation side issues, as well as some of the things around training and restructuring staff emphasis time and that sort of thing that Danielle's explained. That's the way the program's dealing with resource shortage, somewhat complicated prescriptions, trying to be targeted about it and get better at finding where the actual sort of root of the problem is. But I think, you know, with respect to the effectiveness monitoring design question, that's an open question. It's in policy at the moment. I would hope that the offices that are sitting in the room carry that question forward. Is there figuring out what effectiveness monitoring can be for us? So I think some of the things that were discussed with us at last meeting around effectiveness monitoring. The challenge and expense and long-term nature of some of those, and how soon to get the answer, and was able to tell you how soon to think. And I think that's really fertile ground for that measure. Questions? Hearing none. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for your time.
Okay. I think that concludes our agenda for the day, a few minutes early. Staff, is there anything that I've moved to later in the agenda and I'm now forgetting? Or is that really it? Thanks. Do we have reason to go to executive session? If not, without objection, we are adjourned and we'll see you tomorrow.